best stories is the student who comes back and says in so many words, thank you for believing in me and pushing me to do this. I'm so glad that I did it. And those are the kinds of success stories that are deep, they're long lasting, and they're a perfect example of the influence that we have as educators.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of World Strides Podcast, Changing Lives Through Education Abroad, a weekly series of conversations with international education's most interesting thought leaders, as well as discussions on emerging trends, best practices, and innovation happening in our field. I'm your host, Zach McInnes, and I am so excited about this week's episode. Today, I'm jazzed to have a dialogue on financial aid and financing study abroad, as well as touch on access and intersectionality. We'll be talking specifically from an historically Black college and university, or HBCU, perspective, but we'll have takeaways and insights that will be useful for all practitioners in this wonderful field of ours. Ebony Majid is a shining light in education abroad, and I'm so excited to be able to pick her brain today. Ebony is a longtime international educator and currently serves as the Director of International Students, Scholars, and Programs at Hampton University in beautiful Hampton, Virginia. She'll share insights around building connections with colleagues to create a network to support students on campus, shed light on common misconceptions surrounding financial aid, and share outreach strategies that reach diverse communities. I am so excited for today's conversation. You do not want to miss this episode. Stay tuned for what's sure to be a riveting discussion today. Welcome, Ebony. Thank you for joining us here today. To kick us off, could you please share a bit about your background, professional path, and the education abroad ecosystem at Hampton University?
Thank you so much, Zach, for having me. I'm grateful for this opportunity to share with you and share with our audience about this very important and timely topic. A bit about myself, I am actually from Hampton, Virginia, and as an undergraduate student, I studied Spanish, and in my junior year, I studied abroad in Barcelona in Spain. It was such an impactful opportunity and experience. It was my first time leaving the country. So when I returned and I had this earth-shattering experience, one of my first thoughts was, okay, A, how do I do this again? And B, how can I create a career where I can help and support other HBCU students and students in general have this sort of international experience? So that's where the trajectory sort of started for me. I actually came back to Hampton after graduate school at American University, where I studied international communication. I came back to Hampton for a few years, and I was able to work as the director of the international office and spend some time here at Hampton developing study abroad programming, working hard to develop a study abroad culture as well, so that we could move to the point where if students chose to enroll at Hampton, they would expect that a study abroad opportunity could be a part of their experience before they graduated. So that was a great time for me. I learned a great deal. I got involved with NAFSA at that point during those years. And then in 2015, I made a change in my career path, and I joined the team over at the College of William & Mary, the Global Education Team, which is an award-winning team for open doors data, study abroad participation. Their Reeve Center for International Studies is very impressive. So I was fortunate to spend a few years there and learn about a different component of study abroad programming as well. And then after that time, I spent some years at Christopher Newport University in Newport News, Virginia, where again, still on the study abroad side of the house, I was able to learn about a different element, in particular as it related to the financial component and elements of study abroad programming. So I was able to spend time with a lot of the faculty there for faculty-led programming, how to help them develop their budgets, anything regarding money, essentially. I became known kind of as a joke on campus as the money lady. So that was good. And then spending time with students as well and helping them understand the different scholarships that were available. So being the Gilman advisor, for example, telling students about the Boren Scholarship, helping them understand how to best budget when having a study abroad experience and helping their parents and their families understand that as well. So last summer, I returned to Hampton to sort of pick up where I left off. But at this point, I was able to utilize all of that information, all of that training from the previous two institutions. So although I have the same position here now that I did years ago, it's with a different lens. I have a different set of eyes and experiences in order to develop the programming here and work with the institution on its own journey for internationalization. So it's been a wild ride, but I'm so grateful for all of the opportunities and to continue to do the work that we need to do in the international education space.
Thank you very much for sharing that, Ebony. In addition to your more formal professional roles, I know you as a very active contributor to NAFSA and consummate volunteer. Would love to hear a bit more about those experiences and why they have been impactful to you and to the field at large.
Thank you for that question. Oh, NAFSA.
Oh, NAFSA.
It holds, I think, a special place in my heart and in my mind, in particular for the vision and the mission that it has. For all of us as international educators around the world, it is an example, not the only example, but an example of a space where so many of us can come together and share ideas and learn about best practices and keep up with the data and the trends. The public policy branch of NAFSA also does really good work in helping our states and federal governments also understand the importance of international education. So years ago, I think it was maybe 2012 or so that I originally joined NAFSA. And through the years, I have continued to pursue volunteer opportunities that would not only help myself in my career naturally, my own trajectory, but to also be able to share with and engage with colleagues across the world. Because for the most part, we all have the same goal, which is to improve and increase participation in international ed, whether we're talking about study abroad, whether we're talking about international students and scholars, and sort of worldwide use our engagement as a form of soft diplomacy. Because many of us know, you know, when we have these experiences around the world and with different cultures, it changes us and it can change us for the better. So through the years, I volunteered with the Region 8 leadership team. I was the chair of advocacy and diversity and inclusion for Region 8, currently also the coach for the Region 8 Academy, which has been a mind-blowing experience. I mean, the academy and the way that they've designed it and its intention is just, I think everyone should definitely pursue and either be a coach or a trainee because of what it can do for yourself as a human being and also your career. And then finally, I also am a member at large with the Leadership Development Committee with NAFSA, also known as the LDC. And our specialization is identifying, highlighting, lifting up colleagues from across the field to encourage them and guide them and train them to also pursue volunteer opportunities with NAFSA. So NAFSA's gift, I guess, is strength in numbers. The more of us that there are who are engaging on a volunteer basis, the stronger we all can be, and the more that we can sort of push this mission and this agenda for international education and cross-cultural understanding. I think the more that we know about each other as human beings, it sounds cliche, but it is true. The world can truly be a better place.
Thank you so much for saying that. That was downright inspirational, my friend. I like to think of our work in education abroad as making the world a better, more compassionate place, one student at a time. And it sounds cheesy, but it is true. It really gets to the heart of what we do. I'd love to set the stage a bit here for our listeners. In your perspective, what makes going to an HBCU a distinct educational experience for students? And why is it important that students at an HBCU have access to high-impact practices like study abroad?
That is a very important question. It's a two-part question that we don't ask and answer of ourselves often enough. When I think about this, I go back to the idea of intention and why it is originally decades ago that HBCUs were even a necessity in the first place. So if we really strip down and peel back the layers of our history here in these United States, there was a time when people who looked like me or identified as Black or African American or who were the descendants of slaves were not allowed to obtain higher education or education, period. And there were many instances throughout history where it was actually illegal for a person like me to even get caught reading a book. Out of those painful times in history came the historically Black college and university. So its original intent was to provide a space for people who may have been the descendants of slaves or those who may look like me or identify as Black or African American so that they could have a space where their shared experiences could be highlighted and lifted up so that we could pursue education. Now, with that history in mind, for many of the HBCUs, or probably most of the HBCUs, that point right there is very important for why these high impact practices like study abroad are so important. The numbers show us annually through Open Doors, through a lot of the data that comes out of the Federal Department of Education, that Black and Brown students do not have access, or there are more barriers to their ability to have these international experiences, whether, again, it relates to access, resources like funding, money. We need money to study abroad, period, and have these experiences. So with that history and understanding the fact that having international experiences can adjust your existence as a human being, when we put those two things together, I think that naturally answers the question in many ways. That's how I would lay that foundation and answer that question. And it will become more and more important that we speak with and engage with our national advocates, we'll say, our federal advocates, and those at the state level as well, who are in charge of the pocketbooks and the wallets, so that we can expand access for study abroad participation.
I know you are an HBCU grad yourself. Specifically, you're actually a Hampton University grad, where you previously worked in the office before coming home, if you will, in 2023 to lead as Director of International Students, Scholars, and Programs. How has your time as a student at an HBCU informed your professional interests and current practice?
I think there's a certain type of empathy and self-awareness that I had in the past and through time have maintained. I was a first generation student. I attended Hampton, which is an HBCU. I identify as a Black student. Some of the same challenges that I see students of today encountering as far as their ability to study abroad, I also had some of those challenges. So it's one of those things where once you experience, or once you have experienced something that is a challenge for the student population or the clients that you're also trying to help, there's a connection that happens there. You're able to relate to the struggles. You're able to relate to the challenges or the obstacles in a way that you may not be able to relate had you not had those experiences yourself. That's how I would answer that question, is just that sense of self-awareness and empathy I'm able to bring to the table myself so that I can understand these students and their parents and their families as well, and some of the concerns that they may have in pursuing this.
I love what you said about engaging families and parents. It's so key in getting buy-in for study abroad. Part of the mission statement at Hampton College is, quote, to promote learning, the building of character, and the holistic preparation of students for positions of global leadership and lives of service. There are certainly some connections one could make to study abroad here. How have you seen leadership at Hampton University be committed to international education?
Hampton's history is not much unlike the history of many historically Black colleges and universities. Back in the late 1800s until the very early 1900s, Hampton University actually had an education program for Native Americans from across certain parts of the South and eastern parts of the U.S. So in many ways, Hampton's history itself is international. Its foundation is international. And I encourage all the listeners to look up the history of Hampton University and many of the other historically Black colleges and universities as well. So there's a foundation of Hampton that is international, that has a global mindset, if you will. The previous president of Hampton University, Dr. William R. Harvey, was here for over 40 years and really helped to create and further the strength and the foundation of Hampton University. And our current president, Daryl K. Williams, part of his career path was in the military. And he himself lived around the world for years in different places. So when he joined the Hampton family, and he's also a Hampton graduate, but when he joined the Hampton family as a president, there is a certain kind of, I keep using the word mindset, that he was able to also bring to the institution. So Hampton's leadership, its administration, organically is also globally mindset. It has that global perspective. So when I joined the team last summer, the president and I, and also the provost and chief of staff, we all have really good conversations about the idea that more Hampton students need to have these global experiences, and there need to also be more international students and scholars that spend their time at Hampton University as well, either teaching, obtaining their degrees, so that there's this two-way sort of experience that's happening here. So I'll testify, I have seen it myself, I have experienced it myself, that the leadership here at Hampton is organically globally minded, and therefore how they run the institution, how they support the deans and the chairs and the faculty, there's that element in how we engage as well.
One of your previous roles was serving as the Study Abroad Coordinator of Financial Operations and Advising at Christopher Newport University, down the road from you in Virginia. While we know each institution is unique, what insights would you like to share from that role around how a college or study abroad office works financially and how that relates to study abroad?
That experience was a very good example, and still is, of how an institution can position itself so that it understands the financial implications of what it means for students to study abroad and have international experiences. The time that I was working there, there were a couple of types of leadership programs and academic programs that students could apply to and be accepted to, whereby the institution earmarked and set aside specific funding to study abroad. That intention at Christopher Newport is something I would like to see at more institutions. It is necessary. I think it is not fair for an institution to expect the student to study abroad, but then not also position itself to be willing to provide funding to do so. And Christopher Newport is really a beacon as an example. Again, listeners, visit their website to kind of see the good work that they're doing. It allowed me to be able to meet with students to help them understand finances, to help them understand how to utilize these types of funding that the institution was offering. So it made it much more accessible for them to go abroad and come back and testify.
What advice would you give to our listeners on how best to build bridges with financial aid and or scholarship offices on campus, and why does that work matter?
I'll be quite frank when I answer this question. If there are institutions wanting more students to study abroad, it will not happen if the study abroad teams do not have open, transparent conversations with their financial aid offices and their scholarship offices. Like you mentioned, every institution is different, but there must be, early on in the processes, in the planning stages, there must be conversations between the study abroad unit, whatever the nomenclature of that unit may be, and the financial aid or the scholarship teams. One is, it allows them to kind of dispel notions and get rid of assumptions for how things are to work logistically and mechanically at the institution. Each side of the house can let the other know what their policies and procedures and expectations are. That is very necessary. And it'll just make it easier for the students and the family members for them to understand how the processes work. So it absolutely matters. And it's probably one of the main things that an institution is ever like, how do we get more students to study abroad? I would say that's probably the first conversation that needs to happen at an institution is between the study abroad office and the financial aid or scholarship office.
Absolutely. It's worth putting in the time to build those bridges. Ebony, we have a lot of newcomers to our field in 2024. And even if you aren't new, financial aid and financing study abroad are complex topics. I know they are to me. What are some common misconceptions related to financial aid and or funding sources that you would like to shed a light on today?
The first misconception is that the money doesn't exist. There are some students and some families, for understandable reasons, who are like, I got to college, that was hard enough. Or I got my son or daughter to college, that was hard enough. Why would I spend more money in order to also have them study abroad? The money isn't there, I don't have the money. That's definitely understandable, but that is, in most cases, a misconception. There are so many scholarships that are available to students. We mentioned some earlier, the Gilman Scholarship, the Boren Scholarship, the Fund for Education Abroad, the list goes on, the Freeman Asia Scholarship, if it is that they're looking at someplace on the Asian continent, for example. There are so many examples where students can pursue this funding, and I would suggest to institutions that they identify a specific office or a specific person at their institution who can serve as the advisor for those specific funding opportunities, because that makes the application process easier for students. They feel confident about their essays, and you're able to collaborate with the writing centers or the English department. So that would be one misconception, that the money isn't available and that it's too expensive to do. The second would be that because I'm a certain major, I'm not able to identify funds in order to study abroad. And that relates to the first part of that question. The funding is there, but we as institutions have to make sure that we have staff and administrators on campus who can serve as that point of support or as that advisor so that students know exactly where to go. They know I can go to Mrs. Majeed. She's the Gilman advisor. I know she can help me with my essays. That improves their confidence. And it also improves the application rate. Those are probably misconceptions there. And we as institutions must do better to communicate these opportunities to students.
One of the things that always surprises me, Ebony, we, like many other providers out there here at WorldStrides, we have a lot of scholarship funding available to our students. But it always kills me at how many of those students don't actually end up applying for our scholarships. How can providers and study abroad offices work together to help students find these different sources of funding, whether they be at a provider like WorldStrides or at a department at Hampton or in any of the number of places that students can access funding? How can we help guide students in the right direction?
One way could be, if it is that providers, or in your case, WorldStrides, if you're doing your fall and your spring travel and you're visiting all the fairs and the info sessions that institutions have cyclically every year, one thing would be to make sure that if you're able to, with the timing of the visit to the institution, that you carve out time, even if it's just, let me pull you to the side for 5 minutes and talk about it. It is so effective to get together marketing materials that, for example, have that institution's logo or insignia on it. So for example, WorldStrides having a poster, for example, of a student who looks excited, maybe their background, maybe they're somewhere out in Thailand, I don't know. But if the logo, the institutional logo is on it, you're able to share it with departments across the campus so that students begin to see, because students are very visual nowadays. Social media is doing wonders and sometimes not on planet Earth. When students are able to see themselves on materials, I'm talking marketing materials specifically, and their home institution logo was on there, there's something that clicks for the student. Not only do they see themselves abroad in that space, in that image, they say, oh, my school is a part of it. And then toward the bottom, for example, you'll have like a little sticker or a little section to say, to find out more, please talk to. That engages students in a way where all they have to do, we have to get them to the point where they are sitting down with the study abroad office or the scholarship advisor. Once we get them in those seats, because they've seen themselves in that marketing material, that's where we can help them go through the process. And we can get that 10%, for example, closer to 85 or 90.
There's been no shortage of articles lately highlighting how hard it is to work in financial aid. And as a result, there is a shortage of seasoned professionals in this space coming out of the pandemic. How should we, as study abroad practitioners, approach our financial aid colleagues with respect for their field and their work?
One of the first things to always keep in mind, whether it's relating to the financial aid colleagues or anyone else in the study abroad space at an institution, is that we are human beings first. Therefore, we have emotions, we have mental capacity. Sometimes work is just very busy. It's go, go, go. Many of us, especially as a result and impact of the pandemic, have found ourselves being at the point of burnout. So if we can collaborate with those financial aid colleagues to help them understand or have the messaging or the purpose be, this is not additional work when you're helping our study abroad students. It is a different type of work. We're not wanting to add to your load. We're going to tell you how the process is. We're going to work with you collaboratively and be transparent. But that's one thing that has especially worked for me. I'll call up and say, hey, Jane Doe, you know, we have this student. We're going to send them over to financial aid. You can help them out. It's not additional work. It's just a different type of work. And it just overall helps our students. So if we can just understand the humanity in each of us and be a bit empathetic in helping them understand, listen, I'm not trying to throw everything at you, but this is very important. It's just a different type of work. Conceptually, in their mind, it can help them want to spend that additional time in helping the students and their families with that process.
Many of us, Ebony, have heard that changes are coming to the FAFSA. And this is an area that is moving quickly and it's not unmuddled, shall we say. What, in your view, should practitioners know today, right now, about this topic?
They should first know that this will probably not be the last time that there will be major changes to the FAFSA or to similar federal funding processes. One thing is to help students and families understand as practitioners that these changes to the FAFSA are cyclical. It's possible for us to work through them and overcome them. It will take clear and transparent communication. And when helping students in these processes to understand that the FAFSA does not automatically mean loan. I'm not sure where it happened, but in the last few years, it seems as though for many students and families, and it may relate to like financial literacy and understanding how finances for higher education, how it actually works and how it doesn't work. I think there's a lot of assuming going on. FAFSA does not automatically mean loan. Sometimes when they hear the term FAFSA, they think, oh, no, I don't want a loan. Well, it doesn't mean that. It just means the federal government wants to know about your financial background to see what free money they can initially give you. So I think with the changes coming up to the FAFSA, it will take every institution always being on the pulse of what these updates are, when they're coming, and how it will impact the students that they serve institutionally.
Do you have any recommendations for our listeners who want to learn more about this topic? Where should they go?
Start with, I'll say, the main FAFSA website. I've even noticed here recently in the last few weeks, they've been making a lot more updates to not only make the website more user-friendly, but they've added in a lot more materials and resources to help families understand. Again, I mentioned before that idea of financial literacy. People don't know what they don't know. And it's not their fault. It just takes us as institutions, along with that main FAFSA website, and providing them with the resources that they need. That's where they should start. Number two is to speak to the financial aid office at their home institutions. The financial aid offices know that these FAFSA updates are coming and they will continue to come. And it's in their best interest to make sure that they're aware of all of those changes and how they'll impact their student populations and their families. So that's what I would suggest.
I know that one of your areas of expertise is growing study abroad in an HBCU setting. This is both a big and an important topic. What are some approaches you have seen or implemented that have yielded success?
Initially, a couple of things. One is, at an HBCU, for the most part, the majority of the students are either Black or identify as Black or African American, or maybe their parents may be from some parts of Africa, for example. There are more and more international students, for example, who are attending HBCUs. I would say the first thing is to listen. Students will tell you what their concerns are as it relates to studying abroad. And in order to grow your study abroad programs, you have to first listen and make sure that you're addressing some of the concerns that students may have. One of the main concerns I always hear about is, and this is natural just because of the history of the United States, well, I'm a Black student and I identify as Black, and I'm concerned about the idea that when I go abroad, I'm going to face instances of racism, or that I won't be accepted, or that I'll be prejudged, for example, based on my outward appearance and how I'm appearing visually. When you listen and you hear those concerns, you're able to address and advise and guide in such a way to be forthright and honest, but also supportive. One of the things that I do appreciate about World Strides is that, and this is not me being partial, I'm just using you all as an example, is that there are so many resources online as it relates to a student's identity and how they identify and how it is that they can have tough conversations, or how it is that they can move through social conflict or critical conversations that must occur. There are many resources that are available for institutions to help our colleagues who are education abroad professionals know how to best navigate those concerns and those questions. That is the best way to grow study abroad, is to first address those students' concerns, because once they kind of understand the larger context and how it is that they'd be accepted, quote unquote, in different spaces, it improves their confidence and they're going to go ahead and pursue that study abroad program. That's the hope. And I've seen it happen where students come back and they're like, well, thank you for telling me. Like, you know, I had to be careful and I had to, you know, make sure I handle conversations professionally and empathetically, but I had a great time. I'm glad that I went.
As our listeners will know, we love a success story here on the pod. Could you tell us about an initiative or student story of which you are especially proud?
One of my favorite success stories is the student who comes back and says in so many words, thank you for believing in me and pushing me to do this. I'm so glad that I did it. And those are the kinds of success stories that are deep, they're long lasting, and they're a perfect example of the influence that we have as educators. I think over time, we've lost sight of the fact that as educators, we can literally change lives. It sounds so cheesy, and I'm fully aware of that. I have self-awareness. But we really can change lives. So those are the success stories that I remind myself of when times get tough, or when there's a lot of politicking going on, or there are challenges with the budgets that are going on. I remind myself of those stories. You literally change lives when it is that we believe in students and push them for their study abroad.
I can't imagine how many times, my friend, you've heard over the years, Mrs. Bajid, thank you for changing my life. How can our colleagues in the field who may or may not work at an HBCU or other minority-serving institution, MSI, work to ensure pathways exist for underrepresented students to engage in study abroad opportunities?
Do your best to meet students where they are, not necessarily where you think they should be or you expect them to be. Meet them where they are. And what that means is underrepresented students oftentimes have different lived experiences. And I think sometimes when we don't have those same lived experiences, we can, not intentionally, maybe passively, dismiss their concerns or the questions that they have. So the first thing is to do your best to meet students where they are. And if you're not able to do that, then find a point of collaboration so that you can pull in a colleague or pull in someone that you know who may have a similar lived experience. And then you can build from there. Another thing is, when we understand the history of study abroad participation for Black and Brown students, I guess in the last 20 years or so, it's always been somewhere around 6 or 7% of the annual study abroad participation rates where the Black and Brown students fall. If you understand those numbers and you can understand where the obstacles and the barriers lie, you can almost reverse engineer the problem in order to get to the solution. So when you speak to students and you find out that statistically, finances are their main problem. We'll go ahead and collaborate and pull in the financial aid and scholarship office. If there are cultural concerns where a student is like, I don't know, I have black or brown skin, I don't know how I'll get about, for example, in Romania, maybe. Well, do your research. Maybe there is someone on campus or a faculty member who's also from Romania, and you can have that be a point of collaboration. So that could be a way that you can best support the underrepresented students.
One thing I love most about working in international education is that this field is full of folks who care about identity and diversity. With that said, though, what do you wish your fellow practitioners knew about HBCUs and the way study abroad works at HBCUs?
Although it is 2024, it is important that I highlight the fact that not every student at an HBCU is Black or African American. Not every student at an HBCU is in a position of financial need. Now, the statistics tell us, of course, that the majority are, but there are certain assumptions or preconceived notions that we have about today's HBCU student. And I think we would be best served if we just put those assumptions by the riverside, just let them fall by the riverside, and engage directly with your colleagues at other HBCUs and have them tell you, for example, what their student population is like, what interests there are in study abroad. Study abroad has become the sort of thing, probably because of social media, that probably most students, and I don't know the statistics, I want to say like 90%, most students want to study abroad. So please don't think that because a student presents physically in a certain way that they have no interest in going abroad. They absolutely do. And it's important to continue collaborations with our colleagues at HBCUs. If you're working on a grant, for example, a capacity building grant, and you want to maybe improve your chances of being selected or improve how it is and for whom you would use those grant winnings for, go ahead and call up one of your colleagues at an HBCU. Have that be a good point of collaboration. And that just strengthens us nationwide in the international ed space.
As international educators, we know that interrupting injustice and advancing equity are crucial. That said, the current landscape related to DEI across the United States is complex. To make perhaps the understatement of the year, how can our fellow practitioners find ways to support students of historically marginalized or excluded backgrounds in a climate that is, at times intentionally, not inclusive of these populations?
That's a major one, and that is a timely one, and it's a painful one. One thing that we all can do is, despite this challenge that we're having in the United States regarding diversity, equity, and inclusion in the higher education space, despite those challenges, is to help our administration, our institutional administrations, and our stakeholders understand that it is not a matter of either or, it's a matter of and. In order to achieve what we want to achieve, we'll have to do what we've never done, and we'll have to be who we've never been. So what that means is, if there's an institution that wants to intentionally increase and expand opportunities for students, they want to look at diversity, they want to improve equity, they want to include and engage with more students, that is a good thing. We don't have to choose the missions of our institutions. We can have it all. My sense is that with these challenges with DEI, if we can stop thinking of it in terms of being against or in contradiction to what we're wanting to achieve and instead look at it as an advantage, that can help us all. We just need to adjust how we're having the conversation and address it in terms of and instead of either or. We can have it all, people. We really can.
One of the joys of our work is to see the positive impact of education abroad on our students. I'd like to invite you to talk a bit about identity and intersectionality. How have you seen students come to understand or reframe their own identity through their path to, during, or after study abroad programs?
Studying abroad and the pursuit of studying abroad can change us a lot psychologically. There are four things I like to encourage students and our listeners to keep in mind, all of us as humans, really. One is, there's the way regarding identity. There's the way that we know ourselves, meaning that no one can read our minds. Only we know what's in our minds. So there's the way that we know ourselves, number one. There's the way that we see ourselves, number two. And for some people, those are two different things. The way that you know yourself in your own mind when you're honest with yourself, and the way that you see yourself. Number three, there's then the way that others see us. The people around us outside of our own bodies, there is the way that they see us. And then fourth, there's the way that we think people see us. So there's the way that we know ourselves. There's the way that we see ourselves. There's the way that others see us. And then there's the way that we think others see us. All four of those elements, when you begin to plan for and complete a study abroad experience, they change and they morph. All four of those elements. And there's no bad or good, there's no right or wrong to it. But when it comes to identity for ourselves and the intersectionality of the different ways that we know ourselves and see ourselves, how others see us, how we think others see us, if we can always keep those four elements in our mind when we're preparing to study abroad or help students study abroad or when we're going through the process and when we get back, those four elements will change. And if you note their change, it can help us be more confident in our identity and the intersectionality of our identities.
We're about out of time today, so I just have one more question for you, my friend. As you think about education abroad in 2024, what makes you hopeful?
The thing that gives me hope is the fact that, and it is a fact because this is based on data, it's based on research. If we look, when students have study abroad experiences or internship abroad experiences, the way in which their minds, their psyche, their self-esteem, their self-worth, their self-awareness, the way that all of those things change can be a force multiplier to change how we engage with each other around the world. The fall of 2024 for these United States has something very interesting coming up. We have elections coming up, and I don't want to get over into politics, but I'm bringing this up for a reason. The more that we have students studying abroad, I mentioned earlier this idea of soft diplomacy. The more that we can get students to understand that knowing and engaging with people who are from different countries, who may speak a different language or eat different foods or listen to different music or have different family dynamics, the more that they have these abroad experiences, the more they can begin to relate to one another. Because they no longer see and exist in terms of differences, they see and exist in terms of similarities. We can change the thermometer, if you will, on these challenging times that we're having worldwide and in these United States if we can get more students to study abroad, because it really will change their lives and therefore change how they engage with people around the world and therefore change the political landscape, the economic landscape, the social landscape, all of the things. So yes, we as education abroad professionals, once again, we can change the world.
I can't imagine a better place to end things than right here. Ebony Majid, we are a better field because you are a part of it. Thank you for being with us today, and I can't express enough gratitude to you for sharing all your insights with our listeners.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode of Changing Lives Through Education Abroad. I'm your host, Zach McInnes, and please make sure to join us next week as we continue to explore topics around international education and exchange. Thank you to my spectacular World Threads colleagues, Lindsay Kelcher and Sarah Kachuba, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Please subscribe to Changing Lives Through Education Abroad on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and share with your friends and colleagues. Let's create life-changing moments together.